The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'm going to be reading articles from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter and probably from the Harvard Health Letter, too. I apologize for the delay. We had a headphone issue. The first article is going to come from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, and it's entitled Low Thyroid Levels. It comes from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter of December 2022, and it's subtitled When to Treat. If you could see into medicine cabinets across the U.S., you would find a lot of levothyroxine, which is also called Levoxyl or Synthroid. It's one of the most common prescription medications. The drug is a synthetic replacement for the body's T4 hormone called thyroxine. It's an appropriate medication for people with thyroids that don't make enough T4. This includes people with an underactive thyroid, a condition known as hypothyroidism, as well as those who have had their thyroids removed. But levothyroxine also is commonly prescribed to people with a mild form of hypothyroidism known as subclinical hypothyroidism. This diagnosis is more common than hypothyroidism, but there are conflicting ideas about using levothyroxine in this group. Despite the lack of clear benefits, one study found that about 60% of levothyroxine prescriptions fell into this category. Putting your thyroid to the test. The thyroid is a small gland under the Adam's apple. It produces hormones that affect crucial body functions such as metabolism, body temperature, and heart rate. When something is wrong with your thyroid, it can lead to symptoms like fatigue, weight gain, constipation, dry skin, muscle aches, impaired memory, depression, and sensitivity to cold. But there are other possible causes for these symptoms, so healthcare providers don't diagnose hypothyroidism based on symptoms alone. Instead, your care team will send a blood sample to a lab to check your thyroid-stimulating hormone. Another way of saying that is the TSH level. If your body isn't making enough T4, your pituitary gland increases TSH production to stimulate your thyroid gland to make more hormones. If your TSH is high, you may have hypothyroidism. To confirm this, a provider will typically remeasure the TSH and check the free T4 as well. If your TSH is high and your free T4 is low, you likely will be diagnosed with hypothyroidism and prescribed levothyroxine. If your TSH is high and your free T4 is within the standard range, you may have subclinical hypothyroidism. Levothyroxine may be prescribed depending on factors which will be discussed. If your TSH and free T4 are within the standard range, you don't have hypothyroidism and you don't need any treatment. Far less often, both the TSH and the free T4 may be low, leading to the diagnosis of central hypothyroidism. This is often caused by a problem with the pituitary gland, like a tumor or growth, that keeps it from making enough TSH. Generally, if you have subclinical hypothyroidism with a higher TSH level, over 10 milliliters per liter, you may be prescribed levothyroxine. If your TSH level is lower than 10, but it's still above the typical range, Treatment may be recommended based on factors like age and symptoms. Why would you be prescribed levothyroxine? Well, it might be to prevent hypothyroidism. Over time, subclinical hypothyroidism can naturally resolve, or it can progress to hypothyroidism. Levothyroxine can prevent symptoms that typically occur when TSH levels are well above 10. Most cases of subclinical hypothyroidism don't progress to hypothyroidism. There also is a possible heart benefit. Hypothyroidism has been associated with an increase in cholesterol, especially at TSH levels above 10. For this reason, thyroid hormone replacement is often recommended when a person's TSH is 10 or higher. Why wouldn't you prescribe levothyroxine? Well, one is time and money. Along with the cost of the drug, those taking it must have regular monitoring of hormone levels. This involves regular clinic and lab visits. No proof of symptom relief. Evidence suggests that aside from pregnant women, treating people with subclinical hypothyroidism results in little or no symptom improvement. One analysis of 21 studies showed that treatment didn't lead to better quality of life or improvements in blood pressure, fatigue, depressive symptoms, or body mass index for those with subclinical hypothyroidism. Also, there are possible side effects. Because levothyroxine is identical to the body's own T4 hormone, it generally doesn't cause side effects for those with hypothyroidism if taken at the correct dose. But if you have too much T4 in your system, you may experience symptoms of high thyroid levels, including pounding heart, anxiety, and shakiness. If you're not sure that levothyroxine is appropriate, consider seeking a second opinion or consultation with a doctor who specializes in hormone conditions. That doctor is called an endocrinologist. Now here's another article from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, again from December 2022, and it's entitled Fasting When You Have Diabetes, Managing Blood Sugar and Medication Challenges. From routine blood work to major surgery, there are a number of medical tests and procedures for which a period of not eating beforehand, known as fasting, is recommended. While typically a minor inconvenience, fasting can pose specific challenges for people with diabetes. But preparing ahead, particularly for any necessary changes in diabetes medication dosing, can help fasting go smoothly and safely. Low blood sugar, called hypoglycemia, occurs when the sugar in your body drops below a healthy level. Without enough glucose, you lack the fuel your body and brain need to function. In severe cases, a low level becomes a medical emergency. Some diabetes medications can cause low blood sugar, including various types of insulin and sulfonylureas. If you have diabetes and are fasting, especially if you take the types of medications listed above, it's important to check your blood sugar at your usual meal times and at bedtime. If your blood sugar is less than 100, you should follow some specific steps. If you are allowed clear liquids, you may drink 4 fluid ounces of clear fruit juice or 4 fluid ounces of regular sugar-sweetened soda. Refer to specific instructions for clear liquids appropriate for your test. If you're not allowed clear liquids, choose one of the following: a 4-gram glucose tablet, 1 glucose gel tube, or 1 tablespoon of sugar. Then check your blood sugar 15 minutes after the steps you just took. Repeat the blood sugar every 15 minutes, up to 3 times, until your blood sugar is higher than 100. If after 3 repetitions your blood sugar is not above 100, or if symptoms continue, you should call your health care team. If you have symptoms of low blood sugar like pale appearance, shakiness, dizziness, sweating, or confusion, it's reasonable to see if these steps improve your symptoms. The little bit of sugar required to treat low blood sugar usually will not cancel your test. If you take a diabetes medication as prescribed while fasting, you may put yourself at risk for hypoglycemia. It's important to understand whether you should take oral diabetes medications and non-insulin injections the evening before or the morning of any fasting medical appointment. It's also possible that taking the drugs might skew certain blood test results. A popular class of diabetes drug is called the SGLT2 inhibitor, which requires additional caution. When the body can't produce enough insulin, it begins to break down fat as a fuel. This produces a buildup of acids in the bloodstream called ketones. SGLT2 inhibitors carry an increased risk of elevated ketones and diabetic ketoacidosis, a serious complication that can be life-threatening. Surgery also increases the risk of diabetic ketoacidosis, so it may be necessary to stop taking these drugs 3 or 4 days before surgery. Another factor is that SGLT2 inhibitors increase the risk of dehydration, which is a particular concern with surgery. And then there's a table in this article which talks about other drugs that you might be taking and what you should do if there's going to be a fasting procedure. It mentions that examples of SGLT2 inhibitors are Invokana, Farxiga, and Jardiance. And these are the ones that you should stop 3 or 4 days before the scheduled procedure. If you're taking medicines like metformin, Amaryl, Glucotrol, Gliburide, Actos, Onglyza, Januvia, Trulicity, etc., or Ozempic. These are medications you shouldn't take the evening dose the night before the procedure or the morning dose the day of the procedure. If you use insulin, it's often important to take doses while you fast. However, you may need to decrease the amount you take, depending on the type of insulin you use and the timing of your test or procedure. In the evening before your procedure, take your regular dose. On the day of the procedure, you should make adjustments in your dose. And it goes on to have a table that talks about these adjustments. For example, if you take Humulin N, you should take half of your usual dose if it's scheduled before 10 a.m. or after 10 a.m. If you take Lantus or Levemir, which is a more long-acting insulin, you should take your usual morning dose before 10 a.m. and 3/4 of a dose that's scheduled after 10 a.m. If you're supposed to take any kind of rapid-acting insulin, you shouldn't take it if there's a fasting procedure. If you have an insulin pump, what you should do is continue your basal insulin, but don't take the boluses that are prescribed. And if you have a pre-mixed insulin that's a mixture of that is called 70-30 or 75-25, basically, you shouldn't take it at all, and you should just ask your health care provider what to do. Now, next in the Mayo Clinic health letter of December 2022 is a section called News and Our Views. The first article is called Vitamin D is Solid on Defense Against Rheumatoid Arthritis. Vitamin D is known to play a role in maintaining bone health. The vitamin also helps in preventing autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis, thyroid disease, psoriasis, and inflammatory bowel disease. That protective effect was previously speculated, but is now supported by findings of a major study that was published in January of 2022 in the British Medical Journal. The study followed over 25,000 U.S. adults aged 50 and older for up to 5 years. They had not been diagnosed with autoimmune disease at the start of the study. One group took a vitamin D supplement of 2,000 international units daily. A second took an omega-3 fatty acid supplement of 1,000 milligrams daily. A third took both supplements, and a final group took a placebo. Omega-3 fatty acids, found most commonly in fish, have been shown to reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease, but haven't previously been studied extensively for preventing autoimmune disease. Those who took vitamin D supplements with or without omega-3s had a 22% decreased risk of developing an autoimmune disease. Those who took an omega-3 supplement, either with vitamin D or alone, also had a reduced risk of autoimmune disease. But that risk reduction wasn't as great as those who took vitamin D alone. While the specific mechanism for this risk reduction remains unclear, it appears to be tied to the inflammation that underlies autoimmune disease. Both vitamin D and omega-3s are known for their ability to fight inflammation. Mayo Clinic experts say that the study provides further evidence of the benefits of vitamin D in general. Adults should get 600 international units of vitamin D a day, and people over 70 should get 800 international units per day. A supplement can help if sun exposure and diet don't provide enough vitamin D. But talk with your care provider before starting any supplements. Getting too much vitamin D can have health risks too. The next section in News and Our Views from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter is entitled Knee Surgery, Pain Relief Without Opioids. Managing pain after arthroscopic knee surgery doesn't necessarily mean taking opioids. While effective at pain relief, the drugs come with a risk of confusion, misuse, and other significant side effects. Fortunately, a growing body of research shows that pain can often be managed just as effectively with non-opioid medications after these surgeries. A study was done in Arthroscopy, the Journal of Arthroscopic and Related Surgery. In this study, researchers found that many people could keep post-knee surgery pain under control by following a regimen that used multiple types of non-opioid medications. These medications included acetaminophen, which is also called Tylenol, anti-inflammatory drugs like ketorolac and meloxicam, and diazepam, which helps with muscle spasms and cramps. This protocol resulted in lower levels of pain, minimal use of emergency opioids for breakthrough pain, and high satisfaction rates. Few side effects were reported, although there were some reports of drowsiness and dizziness. Diazepam, of course, also has a potential for dependence, just like opioids. While this regimen didn't completely eliminate the need for opioids among all people in the study, cutting back has benefits. Opioid overdose now ranks as the leading cause of accidental death in the United States. To limit opioid prescriptions, Mayo Clinic's Department of Orthopedic Surgery currently uses the non-opioid pain protocol for numerous procedures and hopes to expand its use. Well, now we're going to go on with the Harvard Health Letter of December 2022, and we're going to start with a section called News Briefs. And the first brief article is entitled, Does One Healthy Habit Make Up for a Poor One? Maybe this sounds familiar. You exercise regularly, but you cheat on your diet a lot. Or you skip exercising because your diet is extra healthy. You hope that following just one of these important habits will make up for slacking off on the other. But it doesn't, according to a large study published online by the British Journal of Sports Medicine. The research involved 350,000 healthy British people who underwent a physical exam, answered questions about their exercise and diet, and were followed for 11 years. After all that time, there was no evidence that high levels of physical activity fully offset the harmful effects of a low-quality diet, or that a high-quality diet fully offset a lack of exercise. But researchers did see that people who exercised the most and ate the healthiest diets had the lowest risk of dying prematurely, as would be expected. The study was observational and relied on self-reported data, so it doesn't prove conclusively that you need both exercise and a healthy diet to get the best chance of warding off disease and early death. Still, we know from other studies that exercising and eating a healthy diet are two keys to longevity. And you'll reap the most benefit by following both healthy habits as closely as you can, says Dr. I. Min Lee, a study author, senior exercise researcher, and professor of medicine at the Harvard Medical School. The next brief article in News Briefs in the Harvard Health Letter of December 2022 is entitled, Encouraging News for Former Smokers. Some former smokers think they have probably damaged their body already, and it's too late for a healthy lifestyle to help them. Not so. A large study published online in the September 22, 2022 issue of JAMA Network Open found that a healthy lifestyle enabled even former smokers to lower their risk of premature death. Researchers analyzed the self-reported health information and lifestyle habits of 160,000 former smokers whose average age was 62, and then checked in on them about 20 years later. Compared with those who said they weren't the best about maintaining healthy habits, the ones who said they were the most diligent about exercising regularly, maintaining a healthy weight, limiting alcohol intake, and eating a healthy diet had a 27% lower risk of death from any cause, including a 24% reduction in cancer death risk. Finally, in the News Brief section is an article entitled, Walking is Linked to a lower dementia risk. There is no medication yet invented that can cut your risk of dementia by 50%, but walking 10,000 steps per day might, suggests a study published online September 6, 2022, in the journal JAMA Neurology. Researchers analyzed health and activity information for more than 78,000 healthy people aged 40 to 79 who wore fitness trackers 24 hours a day for at least 3 days and were then followed for 7 years. Compared with people who didn't walk much at all, people who walked about 9,800 steps per day, that's 5 miles, were 51% less likely to develop dementia. People who walked 3,800 steps per day, which is 2 miles, were about 25% less likely to develop dementia. The study was observational, so it cannot prove, it cannot provide conclusive proof that walking itself made the difference. But it wouldn't hurt to try fitting a few more steps into your daily routine. The more steps you take, the better it is for your health, for your brain, your heart, and your protection against cancer, among other benefits. Well, I'm going to stop reading at this point. I don't have any short segments to read. So I'll look forward to reading to you next time. So it looks like we've run out of time for today's episodes of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I sure hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreading. service.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.